Second case this morning, United States against Reyes, number 063607. Ms. Christensen.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Counsel. I don't want to prejudice counsel if they're not ready.
He's still trying to hyperventilate.
He looks a little worried, doesn't he? May it please the Court. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I represent the appellant Javier Reyes in this case. This case stems from an August 2004 robbery of a credit union in West Chicago. Four men entered the bank, and those four men all pled guilty to the crime. A fifth man, Mr. Reyes, was the one that the government claimed planned the crime since he had previously worked at the credit union. My argument today will focus primarily on evidence given by two of the cooperating defendants, De Jesus and Torres. The first issue is the unfairly prejudicial 404B evidence that was admitted through the testimony of De Jesus and Torres. There were four pieces of evidence that were admitted. Three of them were robberies. De Jesus said he and Mr. Reyes had committed robberies in the past, but couldn't remember exactly when. Couldn't remember any other details except for one was a bowling alley and one was a house.
But I thought the district court focused on the fact that Mr. Reyes was planning on using as a defense the idea that he was unwittingly providing useful information to these co-defendants, the ones who pleaded guilty, about the credit union, such as the fact that the security cameras didn't work, and when the man who ran it got to work in the morning and whatever, he was just chatting, and they used it to bad ends, whereas this evidence the district court thought would tend to show absence of mistake and would refute that story.
That's
certainly not a propensity use of the evidence, so why can't it come in under 404B?
The district court did rely on the government's intent issue. However, the court also held that it was propensity evidence, but only to be used for the intent issue. But the case law holds that where this is not a specific intent crime, as bank robbery is not, that the government must show additional connection, forward-looking, fact of purpose.
But aren't you taking those cases out of context? Because here the judge begins by commenting, oh, yeah, it looks like propensity evidence. But then he immediately says, if you are making this particular defense, if your story is that this was, you know, innocent chatter, then they're entitled to show that it wasn't innocent chatter. It just focuses on the actual defense here.
Sure. And that was part of Mr. Reyes' defense at trial. Another part of it was that some of these meetings and conversations never happened, which is a second part of it. He also made the defense that the government relies on to introduce this evidence, but there was also so much contradiction that the primary focus of his defense was that some of these things never happened, and certainly that the defendant's testimony was not clear as to that.
Now, how, if at all, was Mr. Reyes impeded in communicating to the jury that part of his defense, that some of these things never happened? I thought there was some pretty stiff cross-examination of these witnesses.
There certainly was, and that, except for, as our second issue, Mr. Torres. Torres was not cross-examined about the meetings that took place prior to the robbery or anything that happened prior to the robbery, and that was the crux of the government's case. If anything could be agreed on, it was what happened during the robbery. Nobody disputed necessarily that the robbery happened, when it happened. Some of the facts that occurred there were disputed as to who knew how the safe opened, where the safes were, those type of things. But the crux of the government's case was that these meetings had happened where Mr. Reyes disclosed information, and Torres was not cross-examined about those meetings.
But I thought that, I mean, the government responds, well, cross-examination needed to stay within the scope of direct, but if you'd wanted to call Torres as your own witness, you could have done so. Is that not correct?
The government does, in fact, argue that. And I was not trial counsel. I don't know why that was not done.
You just know it wasn't done.
I just know it wasn't done. I know what's on the record, just like the court. And In those type of cases, it's particularly this case that was so much testimony, it would have just been easier to allow the defense to cross-examine him at that time. He was an inmate. He would have had to be brought over again. It was just would have been easier for the judge and for the jury to have him cross-examined at the time his testimony had occurred on direct as well.
Right, but there's nothing in the record indicating that the defense asked for that, asked for him to come back or...
No, there's nothing.
Or press the point, or even raise that with the court when the court denied the opportunity to cross-examine, that, oh, judge, he's here, he's already here, there'll be transfer issues. None of that was in the record either.
That's correct. It's not in the record. I'll address the other parts of the 404B evidence, because the intent issue is certainly the government's strongest argument in this case, but there are three other prongs to the 404B analysis, and certainly the one that is most concerning, aside from the unfair prejudice prong, is that the facts were so sparse as to these other acts that it was nearly impossible for the jury to determine that the acts actually occurred. DeJesus said, well, we did about two other robberies around 2003, around 2002, and no other facts were given aside from the type bowling alley house. Torres had very similar testimony. It was another robbery in 2003. He couldn't remember where. And the final one, of course, was the scheme to defraud the credit union. Although this evidence changed from the government's motion in limine, it was supposedly a scheme to commit loan fraud against the credit union. At trial, what Torres actually testified to was it was going to essentially be check fraud, that he was going to make a withdrawal using a check in another person's name. And in that fact, he said that he didn't want to do it because it wasn't going to be fair, because he was going to get much more money than Mr. Reyes. That questions as to what his motivation would have been. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense for him to say, well, it's not fair, I'm getting too much money. That is not certainly credible. And then, of course, the probative value is not outweighed, or is outweighed by unfair prejudice. This case was hinged on co-conspirators' statements, essentially, people that were testifying for the government for great reductions in their sentences. And to put on then evidence about these types of prior acts, the jury is more likely to make a conclusion that Mr. Reyes is a bad person, that he had been a crook, and that it was likely that he had done this because he had done other things in the past.
But the government did have quite a bit of evidence about Mr. Reyes's responsibility for this other than the 404B. Even if it was a mistake, why wouldn't it be harmless?
I believe that it's not harmless in this case because of the nature of the testimony. There were so much conflicting testimony about what exactly Mr. Reyes told the co-defendants about the bank, the credit union, how to get in, what to do. There was conflicting testimony about who was at which meeting. It changed constantly between the statements given to investigators, to their plea agreements, to the testimony at trial.
Isn't that something the jury sits to sort through, though?
And yes, Your Honor, and I believe they did have some difficulty with that because of the jury question that came out, mm-hmm. asking if they had to be unanimous on all counts. I think there was some testimony, and in a case that's being weighed like that by the jury, all it takes is some of the propensity evidence to tip it over. And the jury was showing that they were undecided. And at that point, one wonders what made one side of the scale drop lower than the other.
I've always wondered after every jury trial.
And we'll never know, for sure. Back to the limitation of cross-examination of Torres, certainly it could have gone a different way. However, Torres was arguably the government's most important witness because he received the largest reduction. He received a 50% reduction in his sentence, even though he gave almost no testimony about the meetings, which was the crux of the government's case.
And then getting back to that, too, again, on this limit on cross-examination, was there any offer of proof made by the defense, you know, pointing out, like you were talking about, all these inconsistencies as it related to these earlier meetings?
I don't believe there was an offer of proof. There was argument that that he had changed his testimony, and that was part of defense counsel's argument against the objection, that he had changed his testimony, and that DeJesus and Vasquez had also changed their testimony. And since it was all in doubt because of all the changes, that that it certainly was proper to cross-examine.
And I'm just trying to get to specifically what was argued. In terms of changing, was it, did the lawyer argue the conclusion it was changed, or did he point to specific facts to show the differences between what was said in a statement taken by the investigators or what was said in the plea agreement? I'm trying to get how specific the objection was made
at the time
to the district court,
testimony?
To the district court when the limitation was placed on the Torres cross-examination.
During the cross-examination, it was not terribly detailed. I believe simply to shorten the time that the jury would hear argument. My recollection is that it was argued prior to trial in some respects that there were inconsistencies in all the co-defendant's statements. And then, of course, after trial, it was argued that there were all these inconsistencies between all of them, including what Torres had agreed to in his plea agreement and what he had testified to and made statements to the investigators. So again, the harmless error comes into question this issue as well, and for very similar reasons, we believe that it's not harmless error that the district court limited the cross-examination of Torres. And I see that I'm entering my rebuttal time, and I will...
All right. If you'd like to save it, then we will hear from you later.
Thank you.
And hear now from Mr. Garcia.
May it please the Court, Counsel. Tony Garcia on behalf of the people of the United States. The appellant in this matter raises two issues during her argument, during the argument before the court, the first being that of 404B and the second being the limited cross-examination of co-defendant Torres during the trial. I'll address the 404B issue first. With regards to the 404B issue, the government presented evidence of intent with regard to the defendant and the defendant's relationship with co-defendants who committed the crime. As the court pointed out, the district court found that if the defendant was going to use as a defense, he unwittingly provided information, inside information for the credit union that was to be used in the bank robbery, then the government was allowed to use the limited 404B evidence to show the relationship between the defendant and specific co-defendants, that being Vasquez and Mr. DeJesus.
Could I ask you, though, I mean, this isn't a one-factor test, if you will, to admit 404B evidence, and one of the criteria is that the proposed evidence is sufficient to support a jury finding that the defendant committed the similar act. And as I understand Ms. Christensen's argument, these statements fall well short of that. If you were actually trying to try a case of the bowling alley robbery, for example, and you didn't know where it was, and you didn't know when it was, and you didn't know anything else, do you really think that evidence is sufficient to support a jury finding that the defendant committed that similar act?
Your Honor, the evidence that was presented in the record would not rise to beyond a reasonable doubt. However, in this matter, with the limited purpose for what the government was presenting that evidence for, is more than sufficient to show the jury for that limited purpose that there was a relationship between the defendant and those co-defendants. In addition,
is that what the test really means, though? You know, I'm sure you can probably recite it in your sleep. It's got to be directed to something other than propensity. It's got to be close enough in time. It's got to be sufficient to support a jury verdict. And then you do the balancing. I'd sort of think of that as the 403 part of 404B. But that third element, why is this even by a preponderance enough to support a jury finding that the defendant committed that similar act?
Your Honor, the most telling,
which I'm not saying that's the standard, but you know, I'm just trying to work up.
Yes, Your Honor. The strongest piece of evidence to show that these crimes did occur is the fact that it was the co-defendants admitting that they committed a crime. they're self-admitting to participating in crime and succeeding, that they were not arrested, they were not charged, and they were not convicted for crimes that they had committed with the defendant. That shows the truthfulness of those crimes.
Well, I just don't know what that third part means, if this is enough. But
yeah, and so then the statement against interest of the co-defendants who are testifying against the defendant at trial, you're saying that's sufficient basis.
There was other
to meet
sufficient.
That.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
To meet that test on other acts.
There was not only looking at the evidence as a whole. It's the co-defendant statements that they participated in the crimes with the appellant in this matter. In addition, it's the detailed information that they provided. They provided roundabout dates of when the crimes occurred, what type of crimes were occurred, and telling was that they were robberies, that they committed robberies with the appellant in this matter. And not only one co-defendant, Mr. Torres, testified about the robbery, but Mr. DeJesus also testified that he had committed a robbery with the appellant in this matter. It's the totality of what that evidence brought in. And to focus that this evidence was only presented for a very limited purpose, one, to rebut the defendant's defense, that the information was provided, that the appellant provided the information to the co-defendants unwittingly, and two, to show a relationship between the defendant and the co-defendants.
But the limiting of it is understandable, and I don't have any quarrel with why the court limited it to, and it went to that particular issue. Just the question is whether or not there was sufficient evidence to show these prior crimes were committed, that prong three.
There was sufficient evidence.
And so you're saying the three co-defendants who all had agreements with the government, you know, testified against their own self-interest and admitted it, and that's sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Moving to this next issue on Torres and the limitation of the cross-examination, it came out, didn't it, in the direct case of the government, these prior meetings and conversations about these prior meetings with other co-defendants? Didn't it come out with people other than Torres?
Yes, it did, Your Honor.
So I'm mystified as to why the government objected to cross-examination on Torres about these prior meetings.
Yes, Your Honor. The transcript cited with regard to the objection starts on page 541 during cross-examination of Mr. Torres. Prior to the first objection by the government with regards to beyond the scope of direct examination, the defendant began to ask Mr. Torres regarding a meeting that occurred on April 22nd with Diana Rodriguez. Without a further offer of proof in the record from the defendant as to what he was eliciting during that time, we can only speculate that it was whether the defendant actually met with Diana Rodriguez in order to obtain the getaway car for the robbery. The evidence that lends to that argument is that the defendant repeatedly, during his cross-examination of the other co-defendants, asked that same question, was whether the defendant was present to obtain the car from Diana Rodriguez for the robbery. Although the district court sustained the government's objection beyond the scope of cross-examination, the defendant actually got that information out. If you read further in the record, the next line of questioning from the defendant actually gets out that the defendant was not present to get the car from.
So was the basis of the government's objection foundational, that is, that the various conversations he wanted to cross on, Reyes wasn't there?
Your Honor, it was not. It was beyond the scope of direct examination. During direct examination of Mr. Torres, we entered evidence from Mr. Torres of a limited nature, that being up to a certain point, and did not include all the meetings that Mr. Torres
had. Whoever tried the case was looking for appears in the record anyway.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The information he was seeking with the cross-examination question got into the jury anyway.
That is correct, Your Honor.
By examination of other parties.
That is correct, Your Honor. In addition, at the end of the testimony of the cross-examination, the defendant did raise again his objection, however, failed to make an offer of proof to the court as to what evidence he was seeking from the cross-examination of Mr. Torres. And as the court pointed out, the cross-examination by the defendant was quite extensive, Mr. Torres. It went into his credibility. It went into any inconsistencies. It went into highlighting a lack of physical corroboration for the testimony that Mr. Torres provided. In addition, the defendant throughout the trial substantiated his defenses by cross-examining each of the co-defendants to show any inconsistencies that came out from the testimony. As the defendant pointed out during his opening statement, he would show 30 inconsistencies during the government's case. Apparently, during the trial, the defendant found that he must have found additional inconsistencies because during closing argument, the defendant argues that he found 35 inconsistencies during the government's case. However, those inconsistencies were not sufficient to acquit the defendant, and the jury found that the government had provided sufficient evidence to find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Now, what I know that Ms. Christensen didn't get to this part of her case, but I assume she's resting on her brief for it. This newly discovered evidence certainly would undermine the theory of liability for Mr. Reyes, that he was really just, maybe Ramirez and others, the co-defendants just didn't like him or something, wanted him to share their misery in prison. I guess I'm less concerned about the affidavit of Ms. Ocasio, since it contradicts her earlier statement. What about the affidavit of Mr. Ramirez?
The affidavit of Mr. Ramirez, the district court properly ruled that there was not newly discovered evidence for the trial. The affidavit of Mr. Ramirez would at best have been hearsay evidence undermining the testimony of Walter DeJesus. It would not have undermined the conviction for the defendant. The government provided sufficient information or sufficient evidence in order to convict the defendant.
Well, in theory, it would have. In theory, it told a completely different story that these guys all got together and said, well, we've been caught, so let's put the finger on Reyes, too. But I guess, so you're making a comparative point, I think, if I'm understanding you correctly, that the rest of the evidence was nonetheless strong enough that it wouldn't, you predict, have made a difference.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, we'd run.
That's fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Ms. Christensen?
Regarding the first issue and the standard for the jury finding the evidence actually occurred, the other acts actually occurred, the factors listed as a jury finding, and most jury findings that I'm aware of are beyond a reasonable doubt. I've never seen a case that says it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt rather than preponderance, but if it's a jury finding, our argument would certainly be that it's beyond a reasonable doubt, and the government has in fact conceded that it wouldn't have proved it beyond a reasonable doubt. And certainly, looking at the evidence, looking at the testimony, it was very short and inconclusive. It's our argument that it wouldn't be a preponderance either, even if that were the standard. Regarding the limitation of cross-examination, the basis of the cross-examination, there was certainly cross-examination of Torres, but the basis of our argument is that it was limited and not allowed about the meetings that took place between the co-defendants prior to the robbery.
Yeah, but see, with no offer of proof, we can't weigh whether that was harmless error or not.
Well,
you know, I mean, we don't know exactly what that testimony would have elicited, particularly when counsel outlined that one objection and how they made the objection and the government's position was, at least on that first conversation, he wasn't even there.
Right, right. Well, and part of that was the Deanna Rodriguez testimony, and that certainly got in, that he wasn't there. But Torres had previously said that he was at other meetings discussing the robbery, and those were not allowed to be cross-examined.
Yeah, but there was testimony about those other meetings from the other co-defendants. True.
Sure. However, all of those were inconsistent about whether Torres was there or whether DeJesus was there or whether Berrios was there. And it follows that there's, you know, it's kind of this avalanche of inconsistencies that if Torres, again, is inconsistent and nobody knows who was there, including all of the government's witnesses, key witnesses who are co-defendants, it becomes a much stronger issue to prove that they were making this up to pin something on Mr. Reyes rather than he was actually there.
Did you ever offer any evidence of a motive to do this? I mean, had Mr. Reyes robbed from them? Or, I mean, it seems to come a bit out of the blue.
A motive for
them to decide to pin this bank robbery on Mr. Reyes.
It's certainly not completely clear from the record if there was a motive for this. There certainly, afterwards, there was some testimony about a debt being owed to Mr. Reyes by DeJesus, and certainly there was some bad blood there. It's unclear from the record as to exactly why they would have done it, aside from trying to lessen their own culpability and their own involvement in the offense, which was certainly a good enough motivation in a lot of cases to point the finger at someone else. And I did not address the newly discovered evidence. I'll rely primarily on my brief on that issue. But the Daniel Ramirez evidence was certainly strong enough to have made a difference in this case. It supported Mr. Reyes's argument of that the other defendants had pointed the finger against him and planned to do that, in fact, even before the robbery had occurred. It also would have called into question the further inconsistencies between the co-defendants, because this actually would have explained them further and perhaps even provided that motive for lying that Your Honor believes is missing from the record. And unless the court has further questions, I'd ask the court to remand for new trial in this matter. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.